Welcome to today's program titled Protecting Trade Secrets from Cyber and Other Threats. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then typing in your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread and is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Robert. You may now begin.
Thank you, and thank you, audience, for joining us for today's webinar, Protecting Trade Secrets from Cyber and Other Threats. It's a great pleasure to present this webinar to you. I'd like to introduce you briefly to our speakers. We have Scott Atkinson. Scott is a senior counsel in our office in San Francisco. He regularly counsels clients on trade secret, non-compete, and restrictive covenant issues, as well as handles restrictive covenant and trade secret litigation, as well as other labor and employment type matters. I'm delighted to introduce you to Pamela Passman. Pamela Passman is the president and CEO of Create.org. Prior to founding Create.org in 2011, Ms. Passman was the corporate vice president and deputy general counsel for Microsoft Corporation. And from 2002, she led Microsoft's regulatory compliance work across a range of issues, including privacy, security, and other issues related to cloud computing. She worked closely with business leaders and research and development teams to advance Microsoft's businesses in China and other emerging markets. She was recently recognized by Security Magazines as one of the most influential people in security. And prior to joining Microsoft, she practiced law at Covington and Burlington in Washington, D.C., and a law firm in Tokyo, Japan. And thank you so much, Pamela, for joining us today. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm the co-chair of CIFAR's National Computer Fraud, Trade Secrets, and Non-Compete group. I'm based out of Los Angeles and regularly advise clients on counseling and litigation matters involving trade secret and non-compete issues. We'd like to jump right into today's program. Briefly, to give you an agenda, Scott's going to be covering identifying trade secrets and secrecy protections, and that's often the first step in having an understanding of what particular information may qualify within a company for trade secret or confidentiality protections, as well as identifying what a company does to protect its information, what type of secrecy measures they have in place. Pamela and myself will briefly discuss why protecting trade secrets matters in today's global economy. Pamela will also address some of the key threats to trade secrets and some risk reduction practices. Scott and myself will tag team with Pamela on some risk reduction practices. And then we'll just have a general overview about some best practices that companies can employ in today's climate regarding protecting its companies from cyber threats. With that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Scott Atkinson to get into identifying trade secrets and secrecy protections.
Thank you, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here with Robert and Pamela, and I look forward to sharing some knowledge and some practical tips for protecting trade secrets. I think it's important to start, though, with identifying what a trade secret is. Generally speaking, trade secrets are information. That information has to be not generally known to others, and it has to derive economic value because it is secret. That value can be actual or potential. You also have to have reasonable efforts to maintain that secrecy, and that's something that we're going to be coming back to a lot today. I think it's important to understand the statutory definition of a trade secret, just so that you understand in a little bit better detail what we're talking about here. This slide contains the definition from the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016, which is a piece of federal legislation passed a couple of years ago. This legislation was the first time there was a federal cause of action related to trade secrets. Before that, it was handled at the state law level, where most states had adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And the UTSA definition is very similar to the DTSA, but the important thing about the DTSA is that it's given litigants access, easier access to federal court. When parties wanted to get into federal court, they would often have to rely on either diversity jurisdiction, tag on a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim. Now the DTSA provides a direct mechanism to get into federal court, where you've got generally, I think, more sophisticated decision-making and also additional remedies that are available. We've already seen the impact of the DTSA on federal trade secret filings. Lex Machina did a report that showed that between 2009 and 2016, there are between about 860 and 930 cases brought in federal court every year. In 2017, the first full year since the DTSA came into being, there were 1,134 cases, which was an almost 30% increase over 2016. And we're seeing that we're on pace for similar numbers in 2018. So how do we identify trade secrets? Well, trade secrets are a form of intellectual property that is a little bit different than others. Unlike copyrights and patents, the trade secret need not be novel or unique. You don't have to register it. It's not only a matter of you don't publish it, you can't publish it. Once it's out in public, you've lost your trade secret protection. Unlike patents or copyrights, where you've got an exclusive use of the intellectual property, two or more parties can independently possess the same trade secret. And it can be made up of an accumulation of things that are not in and of themselves trade secrets, but the combination of those things are trade secrets. This slide provides some examples of trade secrets, and it shows the real breadth of things that can be covered under the UTSA and DTSA definitions. You've got formulas, manufacturing processes, marketing strategies, business plans. All of these things have actual or potential economic value, financial information, pricing and cost information. Oftentimes, pricing information may not be a trade secret if you've got, for example, price lists that you're pushing out to customers, but if you have custom products or you're doing a lot of unique work, you might find that you're charging different prices to different people, and that gives you a competitive advantage. Similarly, cost information is often overlooked. That also can tie into issues with sourcing, supply chain, because that information gives you the ability to compete more effectively. Source code and software is a classic trade secret. Knowledge about customers, their requirements, their order history, their purchasing trends, anything that would allow you to better assess their needs can be a trade secret. Negative research results is an interesting one. That's knowing what not to do to get the result that you want. That can sometimes be a challenge to define, but can often be very valuable. Customer lists can be trade secrets. It's harder to make the case that they are trade secrets depending on the nature of the business. You are more likely to be able to establish a trade secret protection over customer lists if you can show that there is something unique about the customer needs or that you have special insight into what you are delivering to them, such that even knowing who to target provides value to the business. And of course, just general know-how can also be a trade secret. If you're trying to identify your own trade secrets, you need to evaluate them on a number of dimensions. One is the extent to which it's known outside the company and in the relevant industry, the extent that it's known within the company by employees and others. Are you taking measures to segregate your trade secrets and keep them only to those who need to know? You need to look at the measures that you're taking to protect the secrecy of the information, and we'll be talking a lot about that. You need to be able to evaluate the trade secret's value to yourself and to others. Think carefully about how much time effort and money has been expended in development. If someone can recreate your customer list by going to a phone book and spending, you know, 5 or 10 hours pulling together prospects, there's not much value to that. But if it would take a lot of effort to gather the information, then you might have a better case for trade secret protection. And along those lines, the ease with which it can be properly acquired or duplicated by others. If you can reverse engineer a product by taking it apart and figuring out what it, how it works, then you're, it's probably not a good candidate for trade secret protection. You might want to look at other forms of protection, such as patent. And we'll dive into this topic in a lot more detail as we go along, but to protect your trade secret, you need to maintain reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy. And that can take a lot of forms. If you think about it, you know, we have lots of different avenues to protect the trade secrets, and you want to make sure that you have a comprehensive program in place. It does no good to have a really solid lock on your front door if your back door is wide open and you don't have screens on your windows. So you've got to think about it holistically. There are a number of tools in our toolkit that we can use, from confidentiality agreements, which is kind of a baseline indicator. If you don't have confidentiality agreements with your employees, potentially with your vendors, you're going to have a really hard time establishing trade secret protection because it is such low-hanging fruit. You've got to look at your information security. Are you using passwords? What is your control over your IT infrastructure? Are you limiting access to those who need to know, or can anyone log on to your system and access the crown jewels? What actions are you taking against breaches? That can include litigation, but it can also involve steps short of litigation, such as writing letters, demanding inspections, and things like that. What training are you providing? And consider having trackable e-modules so that you can document that people that interact with your trade secrets understand and have been trained on what those trade secrets are and how to protect them. Look at your onboarding, exit interviews, and related documentation. We'll provide tips on that later on. And then also, just you need to think carefully about your vendors and your subcontractors and make sure that your contracts with them have adequate protections for your trade secrets to the extent that they're disclosed in the course of the underlying relationship. Today, you need to be very careful about how you preserve your trade secrets, because there have been circumstances where courts have found that ordinary business practices can lead to weakening of trade secret protection. There have been a couple of cases out of Georgia where normal, innocent, necessary business practices have been found to void trade secret protection. You know, it's important to mark confidential information as such. Even if you're sending it through a secured internal email, if you're not marking the material as confidential, that can lead to a potential waiver. Similarly, if you're not controlling where the information can be stored, and if you have remote access that would allow folks to access your system and then take the data out, that can be a problem. We see that courts are expecting a greater degree of sophistication from companies in on the technology side, to make sure that they have those reasonable efforts to maintain the secrecy. You know, be careful with what you're doing with cloud storage. Control what programs your employees are able to use. You know, you often will see companies that officially support one or two different file sharing services, but the question then becomes, what else do you permit? What are your employees using that the company does not endorse, and what are you doing to control that? We need to think about those issues as well. So what do reasonable measures look like in practice? I want to talk here. These are just a couple of example cases, and they're actually quite old cases from a couple of decades ago, but I chose them because they highlight the fact that these principles have been around for a long time, and their importation into a cyber threat landscape works pretty well. You can see the analogies on the cyber side to how things used to be back before we even had an internet. In Shock versus State, which was a Texas Instruments case, this is a criminal appeal where the company was able to establish its trade secrets. They had a registry of the trade secrets listing them. They used non-disclosure agreements. They had exit interviews. They had plant security. Not only is everything protected on their networks, but they've got physical security at their buildings. That's an element to think about. They provided training. They restricted access. And they generally enforced non-disclosure of the terms. And those steps in that context were sufficient. You contrast that with the MBL case versus Dyckman, which is a case out of Illinois, where a circumstance in which an employee misappropriated tooling and manufacturing methods and customer lists, the court said that there was no trade secret protection because the company didn't tell the employees what they considered confidential. And it's important to not only label things as confidential, but to train employees on the kinds of information that can be confidential. So with that setting the scene, I'd like to turn it over to Robert to talk about why protecting trade secrets matters.
Thanks, Scott. Just wanted to echo a few things from your slides. A recent study, as you indicated, indicating that more and more cases are being filed in federal court alleging trade secret misappropriation. The Defend Trade Secrets Act is now over 2 years old, so it's probably not surprising that we're seeing more cases being filed in federal court. But I think you can see a general uptick, whether it's in state or federal court, in the number of trade secret cases being brought. Seyfarth Shaw is one of the leading firms that was indicated in the study as far as a counsel either representing the plaintiff or in the defendant in bringing such claims. So we're certainly seeing an uptick in trade secret cases. Other thing from the identification of trade secrets, in evaluating whether you want to protect your information, I think it is important that what you highlighted, Scott, is the ease with which the item can be duplicated, either by reverse engineering and independent derivation. I mean, two companies can own the same trade secret if they've independently developed it, and that's something that's important to keep in mind. The issue comes up is when, an employee leaves and takes the trade secrets, and then it becomes integrated into the, quote, trade secrets of the other company. I think in the reasonable secrecy measures aspect that you were highlighting on, that the employee training aspect is crucial. And we are seeing more and more companies going to the e-module, e-training module, and that's something that Pamela and her company assist with. But, for better or worse, and I want to highlight the better, but for, better and worse, the employees are really the eyes and ears of the company, and so they're the ones that are going to help you maintain the secrecy of the information. And also compromise the information. So with effective training in place, apart from, technology solutions you may have about, monitoring email or monitoring large transfers of information, you're going to be well ahead compared to others if you have an effective employee training program in place. I thought what was interesting as far as one of the cases that you highlighted from Georgia about a case where the court found that there was no trade secret protection, and that was the HTC decision. And in that particular case, the company actually did have an acceptable use policy, and they also had computer secrecy measures in place. But what the court really focused on, and this is a word of caution to employers, is that the employer had not labeled its files as confidential or identified them as confidential, and it didn't have any established protocols for handling its files securely and hadn't tracked the distribution or printing or the downloads of the files that were at issue, and had authorized employees to access the information remotely on personal computers with no discussion of measures they should take to protect the security of the files. And in that particular case, the court granted summary judgment in favor of the defendant. So I think that highlights what Scott was showing, was that courts are more and more expecting more from companies as far as protecting information on the reasonable secrecy measures aspect. Now, turning to, you know, why it all matters and, you know, why do protecting trade secrets matter? Oftentimes, you know, trade secrets, the information, you know, can be the lifeblood of a company, whatever industry that you're in, whether it's high tech, manufacturing. Trade secrets can be very, very valuable, and if they're compromised or misappropriated, it could mean the closure of your business. It could mean significant loss in market share. It could mean criminal penalties and fines and sanctions. And I think you know some of these high profile cases that you see, it really highlights and shows the importance. And often it's in those emerging technology areas, whether it's, you know, self-driving cars, the Waymo Uber case, or in some of the, you know, the Tesla case that we've been seeing. It's a lot of these emerging areas where you see they can often be bet the company type scenarios because the technology is so new and everybody is trying to take advantage of it and capture market share. A recent study that shows the growing importance of trade secrets was this study that was released by the EU Intellectual Property Office. And in that particular study, what the study found is, you know, despite their economic importance and their that trade secrets are poorly studied and their relationships with patents is often misinterpreted. But the study went on to say that previous studies had shown that trade secrets and patents are often used as substitutes, but the study found that they're actually complementary, and that innovating firms often use both to protect their innovations, and that trade secrets are often used more to safeguard innovations than patents by most types of business in most economic sectors. Both mechanisms are likely to be used by companies with internal research and development, high innovation spending and innovations that are new to the market. But in contrast, where the innovations are only new only to the firm, trade secrets are often preferred. And there's often a propensity, according to this the study, to favor trade secrets over patents in markets where there's strong price competition, but to use both protection mechanisms where there is strong quality competition. So, and that's what we're seeing with our clients, is that we're more and more inquiries about, you know, they had previously had more of a patent-centric model, and now exploring more on the line along the lines of, you know, should we rely more on trade secrets? Should we have a more hybrid approach? So that's a real development that we've been seeing. Some, you know, cases that have been torn from the headlines that highlight the importance of you know, trade secrets. The battle between, you know, Fitbit and Jawbone. There was recently a grand jury indictment of some former Fitbit employees in California federal court for stealing trade secrets from the competitor. There were, you know, six California residents. They were charged in San Jose federal court with counts of possessing trade secrets from their former employer Jawbone with the intent of sharing the proprietary information. You know, certainly wearable devices, budding technology, very competitive, and you can see that's where, you know, these cases are percolating. Now, the U.S. Attorney General that's prosecuting the case, you know, was quoted as saying that intellectual property is the heart of innovation and economic development in the Silicon Valley, and the theft of trade secrets violates federal law, stifles innovation, and injures the rightful owners of that trade secret property. And so that's, you know, that's another example of why, you know, trade secret matters. Certainly, if you can get the government's attention and prosecute the trade secret theft, that's something that can be valuable to a company. Another case that was recently filed, Tesla accused an ex-worker of hacking and stealing trade secrets, sued them in Nevada federal court, accusing the employee of hacking into the company's computer system, stealing gigabytes of its confidential data, and then transferring that information to a third party. One of the interesting facts in this particular case is that the investigators, according to the complaint, discovered that the employee had actually written software that hacked into the company's operating system, which included photographs and videos of Tesla's manufacturing system, and that he shared that particular data with outsiders in an attempt to harm the company. That action is presently pending in a Nevada federal court. And then lastly, another significant case that shows why protecting trade secrets matter is that there was recently a criminal sentence in a case in federal court in Wisconsin involving wind turbine technology. A Wisconsin federal judge sentenced the Chinese manufacturer Sinovel to pay a statutory fine over its theft of trade secrets from AMSC. A jury had found that Sinovel had taken source code developed by AMSC and convicted the company of trade secret theft, wire fraud, and conspiracy. Now, the U.S. attorney involved in this particular action said that the case was an example of the DOJ being committed to aggressively investigating and prosecuting individuals and corporations who undermine America's competitiveness by stealing what they did not themselves create. So, you know, trade secrets are important to companies, and there can be serious consequences both on the civil and the criminal front for misappropriation. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Pamela about some of the other importances of protecting trade secrets.
Great. Thank you so much, Robert, and thank you to Robert and Scott for the opportunity to participate in the webinar today. I also wanted just to provide some context around just the business environment, which makes both trade secrets incredibly important, but also really, really challenging to protect and manage. When you think about the environment today for business, we have a very, very competitive global environment where companies are competing with not only, you know, companies down the street, but across the Pacific and Atlantic. There's a very tight labor market, in particular for technical talent. We see people changing jobs in certain countries, in particular in Asia, at a pretty rapid pace, again, in particular technical engineering talent. We see individuals using multiple devices, some of them provided by their employer, but many are their personal devices that access their corporate network. We see individuals with, you know, multiple email addresses and email accounts accessing their corporate networks. We see you know, the cost of data storage decreasing, so that companies are able and individuals are able to keep massive amounts of data, massive amounts of email often containing, you know, very sensitive and proprietary information. So it's in this really challenging context that individuals are being asked to be, you know, very sensitive to how they interact with data, proprietary data. But also, you know, we've seen this huge focus on personal identifiable information through the General Data Protection Regulation that came into implementation in May. In the EU, but with impact globally. So there's a very dynamic and very fluid environment in which companies are innovating, managing trade secrets, protecting trade secrets, and engaging with their employees, supply chain partners, and business partners. And you know, when you think about the magnitude of the issue that we're talking about, Robert mentioned an EU study. Create.org, together with PwC, did a study back in 2014 that tried, through using a variety of economic proxies, to come up with a sense of the impact of trade secret theft on the U.S. economy or the economy of an advanced industrial nation. And what we came, again, using various proxies, economic proxies, we estimated between 1 and 3% of GDP. So we have a $20 trillion U.S. economy projected for 2018, and just to think about the magnitude of that, you know, $200 billion to $600 billion U.S. dollars of loss of incredibly important data, information, intellectual property to companies in the United States, to organizations in the United States. And then you think of the indirect costs, you know, the impact on discouraging investment because you can't be sure that you can protect those innovations, and just the loss of competitiveness for those organizations that lose their trade secrets. So it's a hugely challenging issue. We've seen governments respond with enhanced legislation, enhanced prosecutorial focus on trade secrets. And you know, we are seeing companies as they struggle with the impact of breaches and data theft. You know, spending more focus on protecting their data, being much more aware of the external threats and the internal threats.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we've seen is, you know, a classic example. I mean, if a company is putting information on its website and then later trying to claim that that information is trade secret, that's not going to be a successful argument. That's been pretty well established. You've also seen instances where companies inadvertently are putting information available to the public, maybe perhaps on what they would consider their website, but available on the internet, where they may think that it's an internal company site, but for some reason, either through some snafu, it has become available to the outside public without any sort of credentials. In those instances, it can be a very uphill challenge for a company to maintain a trade secret a lawsuit, because the courts are really taking the position of that you should have known better, you know the climate that we're in, you need to really dot your I's and cross your T's and button up your practices if you're going to come to the court asking for any sort of relief. It's been well established where somebody's merely downloading information from the internet that was put there. You know, that person of the public who had no role in putting the information up there or misappropriating the information is not going to be held responsible for simply downloading the information. That's not to say there hasn't been instances where there was a rogue actor that posted information on the internet and then it was quickly rectified and that there wasn't a mass dissemination and distribution, that you couldn't still maintain the trade secret protection of the information. It sort of goes like wildfire these days. I mean, if it's something that is significant, it's going to be hard to put that genie back in the bottle. Particularly when it becomes, you know, publicly available. And like I highlighted in the discussion about the Georgia case, courts are really expecting a lot more with respect to a company's protection of the information, you know, encryption, firewall, and really wanting to get into the nuts and bolts of, you know, what is this particular file? What is this particular information? How did you protect it? And then making, you know, sort of a judgment call. And it may determine about how, you know, tech savvy your judge is. The more tech savvy, they may expect a lot more than just, you know, password protection.
Great. And what I think is critically important, and we're seeing this in some of the cases, is that companies really understand what is their particular threat environment. What are the key threats to their trade secrets, and whether it's in the context of R&D, in the context of M&A, of an acquisition, or in the regular engagement a company organization has with its supply chain, its value chain, its key vendors, it's critically important that you step back and you really understand, you know, who might be interested, what kinds of organizations might be interested in the information that we have. There's been a lot written about malicious insiders. You know, clearly the insider threat is the main threat that companies face. We read a lot about nation states, and there's actually been an uptick, I think, in the activity of nation states. There's actually more nation states engaged in trade secret theft, more resources being put by certain nations in being able to understand the opportunity of trade secrets and actually going after them. Often a competitor will use an insider as well as sometimes in collaboration with a nation state to identify and get to the proprietary information. And we see organized crime, you know, wherever there's a monetary opportunity, organized crime is involved. And with all of the methods that are used, these are generally very inexpensive. It just takes persistence. And sooner or later, a phishing attack, a malware email, a Trojan horse, social engineering, understanding the audience that you're trying to manipulate, all of these, again, are low cost, just takes people, you know, continually trying to get in, and we see routinely that there is a low-cost, high opportunity for trade secret theft. But at the end of the day, I love this cartoon because it really is human error. It really, you know, our employees, our business partners are our first line of defense, and they're also provide us the biggest challenges in protecting our information. So again, stepping back, really understanding what is your threat environment, who might present the greatest risk, who are the threat actors who might be interested in your data, in what context would they be interested? Is it your day-to-day R&D, your day-to-day product development, your day-to-day sales and marketing, your engagement with your supply chain, targeting different organizations in your supply chain that have proprietary information as they play their specific role in your value chain? Is the context of an acquisition, a divestiture, some sort of a transaction that would bring attention to your organization and the interest of what I call, you know, the bad guys? So in this business environment, in this environment with the challenge of protecting trade secrets, in the context of the court cases that you've heard about today, you know, we have this cybersecurity threat that every organization is challenged to deal with. So how can we, as an organization, how can we as a key player on a hopefully a cross-functional team in your organization help the company reduce the risk of losing trade secrets? Well, first I just wanted to share what we have seen and what we've learned working with a variety of organizations across different sectors in different geographies. And we consistently see that organizations are weakest at risk assessment. And that really is where you need to begin. You can't possibly protect all of the data in your organization. You know, there's a huge focus on, as I talked about, PII, PHI, as there should be. There's just an enormous amount of information that your organization keeps. Hopefully, it's centrally organized so that there is visibility to the data, in particular to the trade secrets. But often we see that there's lots of data that's more at the endpoints, on laptops, on phones, on mobile devices, so that those individuals at the organization that are doing a risk assessment really don't know where all the assets are or what all the assets are or who has access to them. So again, really understanding what are the key assets that you want to protect, that you need to protect in your organization, where are they, who has access to them. And again, as I just mentioned, really understanding who are the key threat actors who would be interested in that data. We see that still a lot of different models that companies are developing organizationally to protect their trade secrets, to manage cybersecurity. We urge companies to bring these together, that they have a cross-functional team, with a set of specific joined goals and metrics across the cross-functional team on what they're trying to achieve, that they have the same, you know, taxonomy on the kinds of data that they're trying to protect. That's critically important because as you decide as an organization what are the types of controls that you want to put in place that will be consistently adopted and monitored and enforced across an organization, you want to have a consensus across the organization because it takes HR, it takes finance, it takes operations, it takes legal and compliance, it takes your R&D team, all to implement these controls in a consistent way. You layer that, the CIO and the CISO and the different cybersecurity roles, all of these need to work together in a very consistent way. We appreciate that companies are very internally focused on enhancing their ability to protect trade secrets and ensuring that their cybersecurity is robust. But it's also important to think about those third parties, whether it's your suppliers, your distributors, your agents, your testers, any of those in your value chain. And for some organizations, it's their customers, that you understand what sensitive information, what trade secrets flow out of the company, where it goes, and that those third parties not only have contractual requirements to protect your trade secrets and your sensitive data, but there's a way to really understand whether or not they have the capabilities internally, that they have the controls internally to protect that sensitive information, and that you have a way to monitor on an ongoing basis their ability to protect your trade secrets. We again, I think this just slide just gives you a sense, understanding at the corporate headquarters level, that cross-functional team, understanding the policies and procedures and controls that are in place, testing to be sure that they are cascading effectively to your regional offices and your subsidiaries, and then, of course, engaging specifically with those high-risk third parties. Do they have the controls in place? Are they meeting the contractual requirements? Do they have the capabilities to protect your trade secrets? And so as we think about, what is an effective trade secret protection program, certainly, there are the legal aspects of it, the contracts, the ability to enforce your rights. We're going to talk about some of those issues in a moment. We also believe very strongly that you need to have the management systems in place, and I'm going to talk more specifically to what CREATE believes are sort of the eight pillars of a management system. And, of course, the IT and physical security. We're big proponents of the NIST cybersecurity framework as embodying those IT, those technical managerial requirements related to your IT and physical security. So I'll come back to that point as well. But just thinking about some of the contractual opportunities, let me hand it back over to Robert.
Thanks, Pamela. So as one of your pillars of your trade secret protection plan on the legal side, you're absolutely going to want to have non-disclosure agreements with your employees, your contractors, your consultants. It's a pretty much 100% no-brainer. I'm often surprised with the reluctance. I don't know where the reluctance come from, is whether it's just the energies that may go into having to ask employees and contractors to sign non-disclosure agreements. But it's one of the leading indicators for success in trade secret litigation as to whether or not you had a non-disclosure agreement in place. You're more likely to not be successful in any sort of litigation for breach, whether on a trade secret tort theory or under a breach of contract theory, if you don't have a signed non-disclosure agreement. And typically, I don't view just having policies alone, to be sufficient, or certainly not best practices. Not to say you couldn't be successful on a trade secret claim just based upon a policy, but it's much easier, much better, much more streamlined to have a non-disclosure agreement in place. Other agreements that we see that are effective, depending upon your state, that can help protect trade secrets are non-compete covenants, invention assignment agreements, social media media ownership agreements, computer use and access agreements. It's also important to help protect you on the risk side that you have covenants in place that make the employee that they acknowledge and represent that they're not going to use their former employer's trade secret confidential information in their work for you. That can help you certainly if your employee gets caught with their hand in the cookie jar and you're trying to distance yourself from that employee and don't want to be hit for any sort of bad faith damages. And I think Scott and myself are in a unique position at being based out of California. And I think we often say that if we can be successful, suing for trade secret and breach of non-disclosure agreements in California, we can be successful anywhere, based upon the law, which is very pro-employee mobility, and they really this antipathy for non-competes and restrictive covenants. But it's often a shock when you're talking to California practitioners and a real eye-opener to them that in the majority of the country, non-compete agreements are probably one of the leading type of agreements to protect trade secrets. And so, it's oftentimes people will characterize that as a more blunt instrument. Obviously a non-disclosure agreement being much more specific, much more discreet, but non-competes are used and are typically the legitimate justification for non-competes is the protection of trade secrets. And I think that's something that's often lost on California practitioners, but the rest of the country are well aware of that. And hopefully, as we continue to educate, that California will become more receptive to restrictive covenants that are necessary to protect trade secrets. And going to the next slide, as far as agreement type issues. I think it's important to look at the agreements not just on the onboarding, but also it's your opportunity at termination to have reaffirmations or even covenants themselves if some things fell through the cracks to include those in severance agreements. Some strategies that companies employ to address these situations is having garden leave arrangements, having notice provisions that the employee has to provide a certain amount of notice before they join a competitor, consultant type arrangements, retention arrangements. Oftentimes, in restrictive stock award agreements or equity grants, you'll see restrictive covenant type of arrangements, whether that's a non-compete, a non-disclosure, non-solicitation. But these are all often part of the approach, the carrots and stick approach, to help companies, protect their trade secrets. And it's often highlighted and crystallized most when you have that employee who knows so much, who's going to go to the, direct competitor and attempt to work on the same type of product, work with the same type of customers. That's where, this carrot and sticks approach can be, most effective.
Thank you, Robert. We now want to sort of take all this information and think about sort of a comprehensive way to manage the protection of trade secrets. And when we think about it, we always think about it in the context of people, process, and technology. I mentioned the importance of a risk assessment. I think that's the first place to start. That way you can determine what is most important and you can focus your time and resources on protecting those assets. That involves understanding, what are the key trade secrets, where are they, who has access to them, who might be most interested in misappropriating them, whether it's in the context of internal people, which is a very challenging discussion to have, but an important one to have, as well as external players. And then the importance of having well-written, well-understood policies and procedures that your employees are trained on, whether it's all employees or those employees who in particular come in contact with trade secrets, those involved in the development and innovations that lead to trade secrets, or those that help transfer those trade secrets to different parts of the organization or to external parties like suppliers, manufacturers, and so forth. And keeping records so you understand what you do, when you did it, and how you did it. The issue of security and confidentiality is quite significant. I'm going to come back in the context of a broad information security approach using the NIST cybersecurity framework. But this is, you know, a key pillar of a robust approach. The management of third parties, I've raised this several times, the importance of understanding which of your third parties get access to your trade secrets. Which of your third parties may have some interest, perhaps, in using your trade secrets in a way that was not intended by you. So are there any specific threats in the context of your third parties, your vendors, your suppliers, your distributors? The importance of a cross-functional team, and I've got a slide on this in a moment, really thinking through who should be involved in helping you set those policies and procedures, ensuring that your employees are well trained on them, ensuring that your third parties are well trained on them. What are the different kinds of controls that need to be in the organization across different functions, and of course, information security. You know, Robert spoke of the importance early on. We increasingly see organizations incorporate training on trade secret protection in the context of broader, you know, privacy and information security training, cybersecurity training, really, you know, helping your employees and your third parties understand, you know, what is the company's approach to managing and protecting PII, what is the company's approach to managing and protecting trade secrets. The issue of monitoring and measurement is actually where we see organizations are the weakest. They may have policies and procedures, yet they're not really watching to see if they're consistently applied. They have access controls, but they actually don't see whether or not those access controls are manipulated or individuals change jobs and access controls are not removed. So the importance of monitoring and measuring your capabilities is incredibly important. And of course, corrective action. When you see that your policies have not been followed or a system has broken down, do you go back and really understand why that happened and look to improve it? We're just going to take a few minutes and give you a few examples of some policies that are important to have in place.
Thanks, Pamela. One of those policies is that we need to consider is a social media policy. This could be something that's its own presentation, and because we're running short on time, I want to just hit a couple of high notes that aren't so much covered on the slide. But it's really important to think about what employees might do on social media with your trade secrets. It's possible to put together a very brief, concise social media policy that covers confidential information and makes sure that your employees aren't unintentionally or intentionally broadcasting your trade secrets on the net. A lot of companies have these policies publicly available. Best Buy has a good brief one that I've seen. Nordstrom also has one that's publicly available. And those just highlight the importance of preserving company confidential information when you're interacting with the public on social media. It's also important to have separate ownership of the company accounts so that you don't, and this is usually something, an issue that comes up with smaller companies where maybe you have one person whose unofficial job is social media. With larger companies, you tend to have people who are devoted to that, and so those companies tend to be on top of that issue, but you want to make sure that the company is retaining ownership of those. Before I move on, I want to provide the CLE code for today. It is SS 3016 Sierra Sierra 3016. And another policy that you need to consider is BYOD policies. To a certain degree, BYOD can become inevitable, but you need to be very careful about how you do it. Maybe keep it to certain employees only. Be careful about which devices you permit. Make sure that you have restrictions on the use and transfer of company data, and provide the company with the right to access those devices to perform investigations as part of the exit process. And I see someone requested the CLE code again. It is SS3016.
Another practical measure to take into account is making sure you have an exit interview policy. First off, you should conduct exit interviews. Some of the key questions are in the exit interview topic are, well, who should be interviewed? And the company needs to decide, you know, if they're going to apply it across the board or certain levels of employees will always have exit interviews. Some of the other considerations that go into exit interviews are preparing for the exit interview. You should prepare. Take a survey of what agreements and policies are in place that impact the employee prior to conducting the exit interview and doing an investigation, taking a look at the electronic fingerprints by this particular employee's conduct. Get an understanding of where the employee is going, who they're going to be working for, what their position is going to be. And then who's going to participate in the exit interview? Is it just going to be HR? Is one of the business leaders going to be involved? Is legal going to be involved? And then how to go about conducting the exit interview. You don't typically want to make it confrontational, but on the other hand, you want to make sure you get a free flow of information so you can highlight some of the risks. And during the exit interview, highlighting what the agreements are, what the obligations are, highlighting confidentiality. It's essential to obtain the confirming the return of all company property and learning about what their new position is going to be. And then oftentimes you want to document what occurred in the exit interview, have thorough notes, and at that point, you know, present the employee with their agreements and perhaps ask them for a reaffirmation that they're going to abide by their agreements. And then on the exit interview topic, if you don't remember anything, one key thing to remember is that if an employee is returning company devices such as a iPhone, it's so essential to make sure you get the password, because if you don't get the password, your hands may be tied on doing any sort of forensic discovery related to that company-owned device for which you don't know the password. With that, I'll turn it over to Pamela to close this out.
Great. Thank you very much. I wanted to focus on sort of the underpinning of all of this, which is really building a culture of trade secret protection and cybersecurity. Because you can have the greatest policies in place, but unless you're building a culture of trade secret protection and cybersecurity, you won't make the progress that's so important. And just a few things to highlight, the integration of what you're doing into the way the company operates. If you create policies and procedures that don't reflect how the company is going to work practically, you'll have employees that will do everything they can to go over or under those policies. So, you know, be very practical, be very operational in integrating what you do into how the company operates. You know, the idea of having some consistent standards and controls that you use so that it's very predictable, the organization understands, whether it's the NIST cybersecurity framework or ISO 27001, you have a consistent way to implement your information security management strategy. The importance that everybody is accountable at all levels of the organization. There's a lot of research that says that in some cases it's your most senior people that are most careless. So really being focused on accountability at all levels. And communicating the importance of the trade secrets and the role that each employee has in protecting them. And like many things around risk management and compliance, this is really a continuous improvement process. Thinking about what that cross-functional team should look like, this is a suggestion on a team that should work both proactively to protect and manage your trade secrets, but also have in place an incident response strategy so that, you know, in the likely situation where you are responding to a loss of trade secrets or other sensitive proprietary information, you have a team that's been trained to respond, that's done tabletop exercises, and is very agile and flexible in working together. And reaching out to those external folks who can be very helpful to you in some sort of incident. In the context of standards and controls, you know, we are strong proponents of using the NIST cybersecurity framework. The importance of having a consistent set of controls that you work diligently to implement, and you're consistently working to mature your approach to those controls. We're big advocates of the NIST cybersecurity framework because it is a voluntary approach that was designed by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, a part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, in very close collaboration with the private sector. It was released in 2014 and has increasing adoption much beyond critical infrastructure, which was its first intended audience, across organizations, medium, large organizations in almost every sector of the economy. It's also gaining interest and traction overseas. And again, it really is so useful because it cross-references other standards like ISO 27001, like other NIST requirements, NIST 853. It's broadly used by organizations who interact with the federal government. 800-171, the controlled unclassified information that's required of anyone engaging in the DoD supply chain. So it has a lot of flexibility because it does include other standards and guidance. For those of you that haven't had the pleasure of being exposed to the NIST framework, it includes 5 main functions, 22 subcategories, but underlying that is 98 controls, very specific actions that companies should be taking on a consistent basis. To look at the controls in another way, it really is about people, process, and technology. There are management systems that it anticipates, very consistent with our trade secret protection approach, really thinking through the policies and procedures, the people that should be involved. But it also does address some very specific security domains. And this is generally how CISOs and CIOs manage their people resources and their budget. They have a specific vulnerability management budget, specific threat management budget. So the NIST framework really enables a cross-functional team. People bring different skills and domains and experience together using the same language, the same set of controls, working together to approach it in a way that really focuses on continuous improvement. So I'm going to stop there. I think we have run out of time. If you do have questions, if you can, use the Q&A chat function. We'll definitely take a look at them and respond to them.
Thank you, Pamela. This is Robert. Thank you all for joining us for today's webinar. As Pamela indicated, if you do have any questions, feel free to email Pamela, myself, Scott. We'd be happy to respond. I'll direct you to Pamela's website at create.org, as well as our trade secret blog, tradesecretslaw.com. Both are great resources for education on protecting companies' trade secrets. And then just a programming note, our next webinar will be in September. It's going to be Protecting Trade Secrets Abroad and Enforcing Rights Abroad and in the United States. And then finally, we'll conclude our webinar series in November on criminal trade secret theft update. The exact dates will be advertised on our website, so be looking for that. And if you want to, go ahead and sign up for our mail list, and you'll be alerted when the webinar exact date is available. Thanks again all for your attention, and thank you so much, Pamela, for contributing today's discussion.
Great. Thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.